Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour's Editorial Review. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network as an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour's Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Editorial Review and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events in the light of Bible prophecy, biblical law, and scriptural history. Stay tuned for tonight's special reports right after this message. Well, how many laws did Moses give us in the Mosaic Law? And how many laws has the state given us in our secular government? Well, Moses gave us 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, organized into 133 titles of law. The state, at last count, has given us 2.5 million laws, and they're adding to it at the federal level at the rate of 47 pages a day. Now, Peter said that we ought to obey God rather than men in Acts 5, verse 29. And Congress said that we ought to voluntarily apply the teachings of the Scripture in the lives of families, individuals, and societies. And our Supreme Court has said that there is a higher loyalty than loyalty to this country. Loyalty to God, they said in Seeger versus United States. Now, you know, every authority is in agreement. The Congress, the Supreme Court, and God Almighty Himself all agree that the Scriptures are the final authority on law. Now, to learn these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, and how to use them against government intrusion into your God-given right, is a right, duty, and obligation that we owe to ourselves and to our families and to our society. Now, here at the law school, we teach all 759 of these statutes, judgments, and commandments, along with the penalties for the violation of these laws, and we do that twice a year in the spring and the fall. So why don't you make it a point to regain your First Amendment right to free exercise this year? The First Amendment is the gateway to the Second and to your whole Bill of Rights. Now, the law of God may be old, but it's not old-fashioned, and it's very relevant to our lives and to our rights. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Remember that this Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Hey, there's an important trial going on right now out in Reno, Nevada. Let me tell you a little story about this. It's going to be a blockbuster one way or the other. The little-known United States Court of Federal Claims has set up shop in Reno, Nevada for 3 weeks to hear this case, to hear what may be the final phase of a 13-year legal battle between Wayne Hage and the federal government. The result of this case will either send seismic shockwaves through the government and the environmental community, or it will signal the end of ranching and other resource use on federal land. Well, the little-known U.S. Court of Federal Claims has set up shop in Reno, Nevada, to hear what may be the final phase of a 13-year legal battle between Wayne Hage and the federal government, the result of which will either be seismic shockwaves through the government and its agencies, or it's going to mean the end of ranching. Now, much to the chagrin of federal agencies and the environmental community, presiding Judge Lauren Smith already ruled on January 29, 2002, that Wayne Hage does indeed have a vested water right and title to certain fee lands adjacent to that water on his Pine Creek Ranch in Nevada. Hage has been denied the use of his private property since 1991, when the federal government confiscated his cattle because, according to David Spohr, the government's attorney, Hage continually broke the law, repeatedly trespassing cattle on public lands after being warned to remove them. Hage has contended that the government had no power to require him to remove his cattle since he owned the water rights and the title to the adjacent fee land. Judge Smith told both sides, quote, "We're not here to question whether the government could take what they took from Mr. Hage. The question is, can the government do what it did without compensation to Hage?" Now, if the court rules that the government denied the use of Hage's private property and it constitutes a taking, then the government will be required to pay just compensation as required by the Fifth Amendment. The budget-busting implications of this ruling has federal bureaucrats biting their nails. Hage believes compensation is due and that compensation must be paid on the basis of highest and best use of the resource. Since his property rights were denied in 1991, water has become an extremely valuable commodity, especially for drought-stricken urban areas such as Las Vegas and Reno. Now, should the government have to pay compensation for lost water sales, to which the judge has already ruled that Hage has exclusive rights, the size of the award could be staggering. And moreover, the precedent could open a floodgate of similar claims throughout the West. Ranchers have been following this case closely, and many have undertaken the research necessary to produce an exhaustive chain of title to document their own water and forage rights. Since the early 1980s, environmental organizations have pressured the government to reduce cattle grazing in the West. Consequently, ranchers' allotments have been reduced, driving many ranchers out of business. If Hage prevails, ranchers who have been adversely affected may be entitled to compensation and at the same time be freed from the tightening grip of the federal government on their ranching operations. The broader question at issue is, can federal agencies extinguish property and private property rights that existed before the federal agency was even created without paying just compensation as required by the Fifth Amendment? Hage has demonstrated that private property rights were created on the property that he now owns by Leab D. Smith in 1867, who recorded his claim and deed to a 160-acre homestead. His declaration of homestead includes a land survey and description which notes a lot of land, dwellings, home, and its appurtenance. Throughout the West, land use was based on the doctrine of prior appropriation. That is, the first person to find water and put it to beneficial use had the first right to the use of the water. He also had first right to the use of the land that the water would support, either for grazing, mining, farming, or for any other beneficial purpose. Now, this practice was not merely custom, it was Mexican law and territorial law well before the territories became states. The appurtenances listed in the original Declaration of Homestead included vast grazing areas. This fact is evidenced by the tax records at the time, which included inventories of cattle, sheep, oxen, and horses in numbers that could not possibly be supported by the 160-acre homestead. More evidence comes from a 1913 certificate of appropriation of water from the state engineer, which includes the words for irrigation, stock, and domestic purposes. Now, the question of ownership of property rights in water and in forage appears to be quieted by a 1942 court case brought by prior owners of the Hage property, in which a Nevada judge said that the owners of all stock watering rights, together with all range rights, range water rights and range privileges used in connection with the said lands has by itself and its predecessors in interest been continuously the owner of, in the actual exclusive and adverse possession of, as against all persons and the whole world. Unquote. Now, the final decree of the court in 1942 says that all persons are hereby perpetually enjoined and restrained from asserting any right, title, interest, claim, estate, or possession in or lien upon the said property or any part thereof adversely. Now, the federal government ignored this order issued by the state court, claiming that total jurisdiction over all but the 160-acre homestead of the Hage Ranch. The question at issue is huge. Hage says that if the federal agencies can extinguish property rights established in territorial law and state law before the existence of that agency without compensation, then the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is meaningless. Well, at least the just compensation clause is meaningless. All right, let's see what else is in the news. Got a letter here from a listener. It says, thanks to all the people who give us these information shows. I'm a friend of Jim from Minneapolis. He was a former student. Can you answer this question? When and why is a juvenile tried as an adult? Secondly, could an emotionally retarded 18-year-old be tried as a juvenile? Thanks for the enlightening subject. Well, this was sent to me in February, so it's a couple of months old. I apologize for taking so long to answer. But I kind of overlooked it for some reason. Let's take the first part. When and why is a juvenile tried as an adult? The concept of trying juveniles as adults relates to, does this person have an adult comprehension or understanding of the acts for which he's being charged? For instance, you don't become an adult until you're 18, but let's suppose that you're 17 years and 11 months and you go out and kill somebody. If you were 18 years old, we would presume that you knew and understood thou shalt do no murder. Well, when you're 17 years and 11 months, did you understand that? Hang on, we'll be back with the answer to this question when we return. You're listening to the Law Hour's Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. All of these Editorial Review programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Well, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? It's obvious that something is wrong and very wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, public institutions, and our national consciousness. And now instead of these ten simple time-tested laws, we see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And they teach these ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in our schools, public institutions, and we've made them part of our national consciousness. You know, this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments and even put 22 principles of that law into our Constitution. It doesn't require marching on Washington or getting the majority of people to practice the Ten Commandments. You can do it in your own life and in your own home and your own family all by yourself. And there's still one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, that is the Ten Commandments and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties for the violation of those laws and the benefits, 33 benefits for their observance. And every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call that the Mosaic Law, the law of God, the common law, natural law, karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which is the natural penalty for adultery. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. To order yours. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. Question raised, when does a juvenile become an adult? When does he get tried as an adult? The answer to that is 18. The presumption of law is that he becomes an adult when he's 18. Now, in many cases where a crime is pretty egregious, you know, like a bunch of kids get together and they murder somebody. It could be one, it could be five. There was a little kid, 6 years old, shot and killed a little girl. I think he was in the first or second grade, 6, 7 years old up in Michigan. It's obvious that a 6-year-old child does not understand murder or killing another 6-year-old child. But what about when the child gets to be 11, 12, 13, 14, 15? See, at some point in time, you came to the understanding that there was right and there was wrong. I'm not sure that in our society today, children are taught right and wrong. Now, when I was a youngster, by the time I was 10 years old, I knew that murder was wrong. I knew that stealing was wrong. I knew that adultery and sexual promiscuity was wrong. By the time I was 10, I was taught that. Somebody sat down with me and said, now let me explain this. I don't think we do this any longer in our public schools. We have an amoral society. Now, there's a second part to this question here. Could an emotionally retarded 18-year-old be tried as a juvenile? Not to my knowledge. Once you get to be 18, you're going to be tried as an adult. Now, you could argue until you get to be 18 that you ought to be tried as a juvenile. Because if you're tried as a juvenile, they can only hold you until you get to be 18 or 21, when they got to release you. So you could be a 16-year-old, a judged juvenile, do a crime, and spend some time in jail and get out. Even if you were an adult, that crime might have jailed you for 10 or 20 years, like drugs and drug dealing. Now, if you're 18 or older and you've got a mental defect, then there's a procedure for filing a defense. Mental defect is a legitimate defense. It's called an affirmative defense. So you come in and you say, well, yeah, this kid's 23 years old or 62 years old, but he's mentally defective. And that's the way you do that. Now, in the Bible, you become an adult at age 21. So they use the number 20. So in your 20th year, until you get to be 20 years, 365 days old, then on that 366th day, you turn 21. So You don't become an adult until you are 21 in the scripture. The states have reduced that to 18 so that they can draft you into the army. All right, so there's that story. See what else is going on in the world. There's a dairy farmer asks, you got any free speech? Well, back in January in Philadelphia, the Institute for Justice attorney Steve Simpson argued the case of dairy farmer Joseph and Brenda Cochran of Westfield, Pennsylvania, about a mile from the New York state line before the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. You see, the Cochrans are suing the federal government for requiring them to participate in the dairy promotion program. You've seen those ads that says, got milk? Well, those ads on TV and billboards, the Cochrans are asking, have you got free speech? And the reason for that is the Cochrans say that they're charged about $4,000 a year, which they can ill afford because they've already started losing money in their dairy operation. And it's for these generic advertisements that actually obscure the distinctions between their traditional farming methods and those of large-scale dairy producers. So the case could have major implications for the similar programs promoting a wide variety of agricultural products, including the AWE, the power of cheese, beef, it's what's for dinner, and pork, the other white meat campaigns. In fact, Congress has become so enamored of this form of central agricultural planning that in the past 2 decades, Washington has created federally supervised promotional programs for products as wide-ranging as beef, pork, honey, potatoes, watermelons, mangoes, kiwi fruit, limes, fresh-cut flowers, peanuts, popcorn, pecans, soybeans, avocados, and wool, just to name a few. Well, dairy farming has been in Joe Cochran's family for 3 generations, and the couple has tried to move their operation back to the way it was done in the old days. As traditional dairy farmers, the Cochrans allow their cows more room to graze and move around, and they don't use bovine growth hormone. The herd that they have is about 150 cows. And they have roughly 900 acres of land, 200 of which they own, grazing the herd outdoors from spring through fall, feeding them on corn silage in the winter. Well, in the Cochran's view, these traditional methods result in healthier cows, easier calving, lower veterinary bills, with less use of antibiotics, a cleaner environment, and a superior product. So the Cochran's have every reason to want to distinguish their product from that of larger-scale producers. But the Dairy Act compels them to do just the opposite. It requires them to fund generic ads whose message is that all milk is the same, regardless of who produces it or how. Well, under the dairy program, all dairy farmers are charged for the ads at the rate of 15 cents per hundredweight. That's 100 pounds of milk. The Cochrans don't even have the option of not sending in a check. They explained when I called them a couple of weeks ago, rather the payments they receive from their milk processors simply have their Got Milk advertising contributions already deducted. It's kind of like payroll withholding. The program was voluntary until the mid-80s when it became mandatory. Well, when we started milking our cows in 1975, we didn't know our First Amendment rights were going to be taken away. We're not allowed as producers to vote on this. The co-ops carry all the weight through their block vote. We're perfectly willing to see this put to a vote of all individual farmers. It's wrong for the federal government to force this scheme on people who do not want to participate. Now, Institute Attorney Simpson points out that the U.S. Supreme Court long ago held that the First Amendment does not allow government to compel individuals to speak, just as it does not allow government to prevent them from speaking. Speech wouldn't be free if government could require people to convey officially sanctioned messages. The same principle applies to compelling people to pay for speech, with which they disagree. In fact, Thomas Jefferson once warned that to compel a man to furnish contributions of money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Weirdly enough, the Cochrans initially lost in the lower court based on legal logic that says the government can regulate their freedom of speech, since the government already regulates them so heavily in other areas. In 1997, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a federal law that required producers of California peaches and nectarines to subsidize a collective advertising program because they operate in a heavily regulated industry. But in 2001, the court struck down a program that required producers of mushrooms to do the same because they're not as heavily regulated. Courts are telling agricultural producers that as long as the government controls their prices, production, terms of sale, and so on, it may as well control their free speech too, Simpson said. But two wrongs don't make a right. Restricting one kind of freedom, economic liberty, isn't licensed to destroy another, called free speech. Well, in the federal government, if the federal government is in trouble because it ill-advised 55-year-old dairy price support program, which stores tons of dried milk in caves in Kansas while American cheesemakers continue to import casein and milk protein concentrate from Australia, New Zealand, and Europe, has become a hopeless snarl. The answer is not to require dairy farmers to subsidize a collective advertising program that they do not want, but to end the price support program entirely and let competition in the free market determine how much milk we buy and what price it sells for. Well, unfortunately for the dairy farmers, they're in a heavily regulated enterprise, and the case will be decided on or based upon Hale versus Hinkle and Wickard versus Filburn. The solution that I've adopted is that I sell my own milk. And these people could sell their own milk. And if you're in a heavily regulated state, you sell it as pet milk to the people that want to buy raw milk. And get this, 12% of the people of America, 12% of us, are into organic. So 12% of us want to buy raw milk. Now that totals about 35 million people. So you take 35 million people coast to coast and border to border, and I think that the Cochrans could sell all of their milk to their own clientele under contract. And it was done up in Boise just quickly. There was a goat farm up there, and the guy was selling his goat milk. He advertised his goat milk. It's fresh and raw, and it's $4 a gallon. Well, I signed up for it, and he had so many customers that I was on what he called his extra board. So he had his regular customers. They could come out at their appointed time, and they could buy whatever amount they wanted. On the extra board, he would call us and say, well, we got 40 gallons of milk left over today. So if you want to come out and get some, you can. So then I would come out and get it. But you see, he'd already sold out. So if the regular customer didn't come in and pick up their milk, whatever was left over, the extra board got, he sold all of it every day. He was getting $4 a gallon. Now, the price of milk is going to go up to $4 a gallon, and the dairymen are getting about $1 a gallon or $1.15. Now, if milk sells for $3 a gallon and the dairyman gets $1, why does he get one-third for producing it all? And the retailers and the Mid-America dairy co-op, they get $2. Doesn't seem like it's exactly fair to me. So if I was a dairy producer, I would want to take $3. I teach a school on that very subject. I'm going to make $100,000 for 5 years. All right, hang on. We'll be back with the closer when we return right after this break. right, we're back for the closer. You're listening to the Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Your support of Truth Radio and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. It's truthradio.com. That's truthradio.com. Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization. We're established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution, and donations are not tax-deductible. If they were tax-deductible, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth, so we rely upon the financial support of our listening audience, a wild new idea. It helps us pay for our satellite time, internet audio streaming, and our overhead costs, and keeps government out of our broadcasting operation. And we want to thank each and every one of you for your financial support. It comes through your donations that you make to Truth Radio at Post Office Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. Again, that's Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Napomo, N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. Well, let's see if we've got a wise old saying. You know, no matter how long you shop for an item, after you've bought it, it will be on sale cheaper somewhere else. Well, here's a little piece here on an expose. Listen to this story. You know, you may be interested in the following information. One of the richest untapped sources of information on the development of the New World Order and of our modern enslavement. I was employed by the OCLC, that's the Online Computer Library Corporation. It's a multi-billion dollar corporation involved with cataloging library books and other ventures to assist in a National Endowment for the Humanities project at Columbia University. Now, the purpose of the grant was to preserve documents on economic and social history from 1850 to 1950. My job was to go through hundreds of rolls of microfilm and to translate all non-English titles into English, fill in bibliographical information, and to provide subject headings. Now, about half of these books were actually in English, and I paid very close attention to them also. And I actually read hundreds of pages of documents and books. Although many of these documents were boring, at least on the surface, dealing with subjects like shoelace manufacturing in northern Germany in the early 1930s, the whole project was concerned with the development of socialism in the United States and its demoralization, and I strongly suspect that those behind the project saw these as good things. I was not able to copy any of these documents. However, I am able to list a large number of the subjects discussed, and I actually got paid to study the history of the theft of our liberty and our form of government. And I was exposed to documents that are unlikely to ever be read by another Christian patriot, unless I can find someone that is interested in the New York area, or who is willing to travel there to examine these texts. So the subjects discussed in these documents include the following list: socialist pamphlets, Communist Party of America documents, labor union documents showing direct and open connections with the Communist Party, Communist Party literature on co-ops, English and German literature on eugenics, arguments for and against the gold and silver standard, arguments for and against a central bank, documents of Federal Reserve System and the connected bankers, arguments from the 1920s for sex education, documents on public education, the original Boy Scout documents from its founding years, specifically stating that the Boy Scouts were founded for the purpose of promoting globalism and the one world government. Documents concerning welfare, social security system documents, proceeds of meetings and other documents arguing for instituting driver's licenses. These were from the 1930s. The League of Nations documents and arguments for founding the League of Nations. Arguments for withholding taxes, income taxes, the founding of the IRS, and gun control arguments. Roosevelt reforms. And huge numbers of economic analyses from a socialist perspective. The list is only a fraction of what is included, and there were many roles that I did not see. There were tens of thousands of documents, since it ranges from 1850 to 1950. Civil War and post-Civil War era attacks on our freedom undoubtedly are included. Regretfully, the older rolls did not tend to have any foreign languages in them, so I had no legitimate reason to access them in order to explore them. I would suspect that they would be very enlightening. Anyone researching these subjects for books or articles should be made aware of this resource. Now, I don't know how hard it is to get into the Columbia stack, but there is usually a way for resourceful researchers. So if you know of any such people, please alert them to this resource. My normal job for the OCLC concerned Semitic, Persian, and Indic language translation. Normally, I would not have been asked to work with German, French, and other European languages, and I'm very convinced that God put me into that situation. So I pray that I can lead to the right people finding and using it. For information, you might want to look at www.columbia.edu. All right. Thanks a lot, Jim, for sending that piece of information. Now, let's see what else we got. Here's the Halliburton Pentagon in dispute over cost of feeding troops in Iraq. You know, Halliburton's getting paid to feed the troops. It's being done by a private contractor. Seeking to defuse a growing election year issue, the Halliburton company said that it had stopped billing the Pentagon for the cost of feeding American troops in Iraq and Kuwait until a dispute over the number of meals served is resolved. The Houston-based company said in a statement that its Kellogg Brown & Root subsidiary was withholding bills totaling $175 million for meal planning, food purchase, and meal preparation costs incurred by subcontractors. Now, the company said it would also defer further billing to the Defense Department for meal costs until the Army and Kellogg Brown & Root resolved their differences. The company has not disclosed the amount of its weekly or monthly bills to the Pentagon for meal costs. Halliburton's actions on Monday came 2 weeks after the company agreed to repay the government for overcharges estimated at $27 million for meals served to American troops at five military bases in Iraq and Kuwait last year. Pentagon auditors are also reviewing the 53 remaining dining facilities in Kuwait and Iraq operated by Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Now, Kellogg, Brown, and Root's president and chief executive, Randy Harrell, said the company's decision on Monday to suspend its billing should not be interpreted as a sign of wrongdoing. This is not any sort of admission, Mr. Harrell said in the statement. As a responsible government contractor, it's the right thing to do. KBR is a good steward of the taxpayers' dollars. Now, there's no need for Halliburton or Kellogg, Brown, and Root to steal. They've already got a lucrative contract that they didn't even have to competes with anybody else over. They just name their price and they're getting paid what they want. So there isn't any need for any skullduggery here. Last month, the company disclosed that two employees had taken kickbacks from a Kuwaiti subcontractor who was providing services to American troops in Kuwait. So the company reimbursed the government $6.3 million. Kellogg Brown and Root has also been involved in a debate over whether it overcharged for gasoline shipments to Iraq under a military contract. While military officials cleared the company of any wrongdoing, the Pentagon Inspector General is investigating the matter. Well, let's see. You've suspended payments, you refunded $6 million, and you're under investigation for overcharging on gasoline. Huh. Well, gee, if you went into a Walmart store and they said, well, gee, we thought that you were over here beating up on people in the back aisle, and we think that you're shoplifting, and we think that maybe you're parked in the wrong place in front of the building. I mean, you know, makes it a little bit suspicious when you're looking at these people in three separate areas, doesn't it? I don't know. Maybe I'm just old and filled with doubt. Well, anyway, the Democrats have said that they'll use the company's ties to the Bush administration as a campaign issue. And Halliburton has recently responded in advertisements on television suggesting that it is being unfairly singled out. Vice President Dick Cheney is a former chief executive of Halliburton. Now, a Halliburton spokeswoman, Wendy Hall, said Monday that suspending the billings was part of the effort to make the company less of a political target. We're doing this to take the issue off the table from a political standpoint, Ms. Hall said in an email. We understand it is an election year and the war will be an important part of that election. But worrying about the election coverage doesn't feed soldiers. That's our job. That's what we're concerned about. So Kellogg Brown and Root said that it had served more than 50 million meals to soldiers in the last year. The dispute centers on a discrepancy between the number of troops the company estimated that it would feed and the number of meals actually served. Well, let's see. They served 50 million meals. Well, if you took 130,000 and then you multiplied that times 3, now that would be 390,000 meals a day times 365 would be 142,350,000 meals a year. So 50 million meals doesn't seem like an exaggeration. Evidently, the Army must have other means because the 50 million meals only represents one-third of the total number of meals that 130,000 soldiers are going to consume. And you know, there's 130,000 soldiers in Iraq. There might be another 20 or 30,000 in Kuwait. So I don't know that 50 million is an exaggeration. It doesn't appear to be when we tap it out on our Texas Instruments Sharp machine. Well, we're about out of time. Give you a reminder here. The Law Hour is brought to you by Truth Radio Network of Napomo, California. Now, for more information on the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, go to the website.